Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're starting the show by talking about a book exploring the histories of our state's lakes, rivers, and waterfalls. It's called Wisconsin Waters, subtitled The Ancient History of Lakes, Rivers, and Waterfalls. And our guest is the author, Scott Spoolman. He's a science writer who focuses on the environmental sciences, especially those stories of natural science and the environment related to Wisconsin and a lot to surrounding states as well. And as we talk with him, he's written a dandy book. I hope you'll join in with your own questions, maybe about how a river near you was formed. What do you want to know about the Great Lakes? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Scott Spoolman, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thanks, Larry. My pleasure.
So why did you decide to write this book? It's a big undertaking. I mean, there's about 280 pages in it. Why? And it's a little different from some of your other books, so I'll give you a two-parter here.
Okay. What,
not only why, but what's the book's purpose in your mind?
Okay. Well, a few years ago, I wrote Wisconsin State Parks, Geology and Natural History of the Parks. And that book did very well. It's quite popular still to this day. And what motivated me to do that was I was fascinated by the geology and natural history of Wisconsin and the variety of landscapes that we have. And I thought, well, by going to the state parks, I could be the entry points for an exploration of each of these different landscapes. And so I did that. That explained the geology and natural history of each part of the state using the state parks as the entry points. But then I thought, after that book came out and did quite well, fortunately, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press was willing to take a chance on Wisconsin Waters, which was the same idea: learn about the ancient history of an area by going to its waterway. And how did that lake get there? How did that river get there? What's the story behind the Great Lakes shores and that sort of thing?
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it's certainly not a textbook. It's one any of us can pick up and read. And nice thing is, because of guides and so forth that you have in the book, it's one of those things you can just kind of take along with you.
Yeah, that's the idea. With the travel guides in the state parks, I had trail guides for each state park that you could hike and see the evidence that I talked about in the text part of the book. And then this is the same thing with water. With travel guides, you can get in your car, get on your bike, and take a route and explore a waterway or go to key points along the river, let's say, in the Mississippi, and see what's going on there, what the story of that is.
You know, you start the book with a necessary question, I think, which I want to ask you now. And I've had this question from my daughter, as a matter of fact, when she was little, which is, where did all the water come from?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and it's still debated. I think the original idea was, or the earlier idea was, that the water was, that comets and asteroids with water on them were slamming into the Earth, and the water would come out of those bodies and just kind of spread around the globe. Of course, it had to happen after the Earth had cooled enough to hold the water. And then, but there's a more recent theory that there is water stored in like glass crystals type formations under the crust of the Earth, or under it, and that water has migrated up to the surface. It's hard to imagine, really, either one of those scenarios. And so I think it's still kind of an unanswered question.
So for my daughter asked about rivers, she said, well, why don't they run out of water?
That's a great question.
And I and I have, why don't they run out of water? So how do you tell a child or anybody for that matter, why don't they run out of water?
See, that's the kind of question kids come up with, you know? It's a wonderful question. Well, the water comes, the water's part of a cycle. Each river is part of a cycle, and the water flows down the river and into a body of water like the ocean or a big lake. It evaporates back up into the atmosphere and then comes down as rain and snow, feeds the groundwater, which is the aquifers, and that's generally where the water that feeds the river comes from. So it's all part of a big cycle. A river's just one part of a big cycle going on all the time.
Well, I answered it, but not as eloquently as you did.
Thank you.
That was a nice answer. But you do point out that fresh water is a finite resource.
Yes, it is. And that's actually something I think a lot of people don't realize. You think it's going to might last forever if we take care of it. But there's only so much water on the earth. There's nobody supplying bringing in a new supply. It's here, and that's all we've got.
Yeah, and we're going to have to be careful with it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, be careful with it. You must have come across some surprises. And I'll say one of the things I liked about your book that we were talking about before the show, but I wanted to mention on air, is really interesting to me. I've visited so many of our lakes and rivers and our Great Lakes and spent a lot of time on the water. But I have enjoyed in reading your book learning more about those waters where I spent a lot of time. The background information of how a particular river or a particular lake or whatever was formed was really interesting to me. Now I spend a lot of time on the Madison Lakes, for example. Were there surprises that you...
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, let's take the Madison
Lakes.
That's
part of the fun of doing this sort of work. Madison Lakes I didn't know this, they lie in an ancient river valley that was once about 300 feet deep. So if you went to Olin Turville Park and stood on the point there or went out to Picnic Point and looked down, you'd be back in 10,000 years ago or more, you'd be looking down into a deep river valley. Big river sweeping through the area, you know, going along the isthmus and then around it, and then on down to following the course of the Yahara River, basically. But it was a deep, old, ancient river in bedrock, sandstone. And then the glaciers came and changed everything, of course, and they basically filled that valley with all of the glacial debris, sand, gravel, rock, boulders. And that's why it's a shallower valley now, and the lakes were created by these big, huge chunks of ice that got left, pulled off the, or fell off the glacier and then just gradually melted away. So, that was a surprise to learn that there was a big, deep valley flowing through there.
Lucas in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Lucas, hi.
Hi, Lucas.
We got Lucas?
Yep. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for calling.
Caller. Yeah, I'm curious about Avoca Lake in Iowa County. It's fairly apparent that it was at one time a part of the Wisconsin River, the lower Wisconsin. But just curious on the history, when it was formed, there's a big prairie kind of north of it that divides that lake from the main Wisconsin River channel. So,
Did you say Avoca, A-V-O-C-A?
Correct.
Avoca Lake.
And it's near the Wisconsin River. I'm not that familiar with that lake, but I could probably guess that you say that you believe it was part of the Wisconsin River at one time, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's shaped like the river. It runs parallel with the river. It does connect on either end, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, it's probably something like one version of that is an oxbow where a river is flowing along, and then it will find a new course that will... The river creates a kind of a curlicue or a hook shape, and then eventually it finds a shortcut across. It cuts a new channel across and leaves that old channel sitting there, and then eventually it kind of becomes isolated from the lake. It sounds like that to me. I'm going to have to look it up. I want to find out myself.
Yeah, but that's probably
guessing, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably how it happened. Lucas, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We well, you were talking about the Madison Lakes. You know, another area I've spent a lot of time is Horicon Marsh.
Oh yeah.
Anything surprising for you when it comes to Horicon Marsh?
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know that it had been thoroughly trashed at one time. It was just destroyed basically by farming, logging, farming, overhunting. You know, draining it to make farms and so on. The peat got fire and burned. The huge peat deposits underneath burned. I didn't realize that all that had happened. And then, fortunately, folks got together and decided, let's stop this, arrest this deterioration and restore it. And it has restored itself, basically.
Well, it's the has one of the largest freshwater cattail marshes,
yes,
isn't it?
It is. In the one of the largest in the world. It might be the largest in North America. I sometimes get mixed up on this, but it's either the largest in North America or one of the largest.
Ron in Antigo, let's go to you next. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I have a question about groundwater elevation. Can you explain how it's possible to have a hill outcropping be at a higher elevation than maybe wetlands that would surround the hill, but yet the water table on that higher hill is actually a little bit higher than those surrounding wetlands?
Well, that's a great question, Ron. I would say it has to do with the bedrock under the hill or the whatever makes up the hill. It's probably maybe a bedrock hill, and then up on top is if you could do an X-ray, you'd see like a little sort of lake of groundwater under the surface on top of the hill, or perhaps it's just sand water or sandstone holding that water, and then it percolates up. Even though it's higher than the surrounding area, it still percolates up just because of the way water works underground.
Yeah, interesting. Ron, thanks. Appreciate the call. We had Horicon Marsh. Oh, the Wisconsin Dells. I mean, kind of anybody in the state would know the Wisconsin Dells. Anything surprising about that?
Well, I would imagine some people do know this, especially if they've done the boat tour up there. But that, the beautiful canyon, Sandstone Canyon, was created probably in a matter of weeks or maybe months. But at any rate, eye blinks on a geologic time scale, just finger snaps in time, because what happened was the Great Glacial Lake, Wisconsin, was stored. It was a big glacial lake, meltwater coming off the glacier that got stored up there in the sand, what are now the sand counties, and they were held back by these ice dams. And when the ice dams melted, that water took off. Yeah,
and that water took off,
and it drained. It drained that big lake that had sat there for 3,000 years. Drained it in a matter of weeks or months. And in the process, all that massive force of the water draining just chewed through that sandstone, created that beautiful canyon.
Yeah, fascinating. Greg in Waukesha, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Greg.
Thank you. I recently read that the number of beavers in North America, in Canada, in the northern reaches of the U.S., is on the rise, and that the number of beaver ponds is also on the rise. So I was wondering if we are seeing any of this in Wisconsin, and if there are any of our current lakes that started life as beaver ponds.
That's a really good question. I'm not too familiar with the story of the beavers. I do know that that there's more respect now for beaver dams than there used to be. That the knee-jerk response was to go out and blow up the beaver dam so it didn't flood your land. But now we realize how important beaver ponds are for the ecosystem, and people are less willing to go and blow them up, destroy the beaver dams. So it could just be that there's more respect for it, and they are on the rise in Wisconsin. I suspect they are. As far as what was the other question?
Did they have, in fact, create lakes that existed?
Oh, I would say it's usually more the other way. Usually, lakes eventually become wetlands because they eventually, and over long, long periods of time, lakes eventually fill in from the edges to become wetlands. I don't think that beaver ponds turn into lakes, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I just don't know.
I think you're right. It's a good way to look. It actually works in the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that brings the beavers in once the lake is gone.
Right.
Greg, thank you so much for calling. Scott Spoolman, our guest today. His book is titled Wisconsin Waters, and the subtitle, The Ancient History of Lakes, Rivers, and Waterfalls. Join in with your questions, comments. Love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we talk with Scott Spoolman, writer whose latest book is Wisconsin Waters, The Ancient History of Lakes, Rivers, and Waterfalls. Callers online, let's go back to the phones. Michael in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I've always been interested in Wisconsin waters, and I think of the history of Wisconsin as being conditioned by or kind of directed by that network of rivers and streams that allowed people access in the days before there were roads and other good ways of getting about. And so when I think of here I am in Madison, and I think about the fact that if I get in the Madison Lake, if I go downstream, I will end up at St. Louis. We were sort of the outskirts of St. Louis. Whereas if I go just a little bit to the northwest or to the north, I'll get into the Fox River Valley. And that, of course, flows to Lake Winnebago and to the Great Lakes and on down to French Canada. And so that was the other, we're sort of at the watershed here between those two big networks. My question for Scott is that my father's family settled in the Princeton Green Lake area along the Fox River, Mount Tom area. And I know that Princeton was a steamboat destination in the mid-1800s. That town, Princeton, was founded in 1848, and they were a steamboat destination. And my question to Scott is, what was the navigability of the Fox River and other you know, Wisconsin River and so on before engineering helped that enterprise?
Hmm. Hi, Michael. That's a really good question. I would say that there was no navigation before there were dams. The dams on the Fox, the lower Fox, used to be quite a interesting, beautiful, kind of a relatively steep drop. There were a lot of waterfalls and rapids in the lower Fox. Now it's all dammed up, and it's just a big navigation channel. And that would be, I think, that would be, let's see, the Fox comes out of Lake Winnebago, so then you would have gone upstream. But before there were dams, there was no navigation. The Native Americans, the indigenous people, used a lot of the waterways, and they would go one direction or the other. As you described, there are divides in our state that divide which way the waters flow, to the southwest, to the north, east, and so, yeah, they used them, if you want to consider that navigation. The indigenous people and early European explorers used the waterways extensively.
And Michael, thanks a lot. And I do want to mention that you do spend some time talking about how humans, in your book, about how humans have made use of waterways both in the past and present. And why do you think that was important to include that human history?
We're still part of nature, and we're part of the natural system, but early humans were so much more ingrained in it or a part of it, and indigenous people they depended on the waters more than we do, really. I mean, we pump the water, we pump groundwater, we still use the Mississippi for shipping, obviously, but the native people had the rivers and waterways were their highways. That's how they got from one part of the state to another, or from one region to another. And it is kind of fascinating to think that the lakes in my hometown country area of Hayward, the Hayward Lakes, are connected to the Gulf of Mexico by natural rivers. It's fun to think of it that way, too. So,
well, spent a lot of time in that Hayward area myself. Yeah. So it is fascinating to think of it that way. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it. Stan and De Pere. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
To you as well.
I live by the Fox River in De Pere, and it's one of the and it flows into Green Bay, and it's one of the very, very few major rivers that flow south to north instead of north to south. And I'm wondering why that is, and also why do all the other rivers flow the other direction?
Well, the Fox is it flows with the lay of the land, and there's a divide back in the area of Lake Winnebago, the Winnebago Pool, those lakes Butamort and I've forgotten the other lake's name now, but the water from in that area flows to the southeast or to the southwest or northeast, basically toward the Mississippi or toward the Great Lake, toward Lake Michigan, and so that's why it flows. I'm sure there are other little streams that flow north or northwest, northerly, kind of. Another example is the Bois Brule up far north. That flows off of a divide north into Lake Superior. And then the St. Croix, which originates in the same headwaters area, flows southeast. Southwest. Sorry, I get those mixed up. I think that explains it. The lay of the land. Water takes the lay of the land. Yeah.
Yeah. Stan, thanks. Joe in Lake Halley, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I heard your guest, I just tuned in. He was talking about beavers. I actually bought 20 acres of kind of hunting rec land, and it's has about a quarter of the lake shore on a small landlocked pond. And I've got beavers there that are, they're destroying all these big poplar trees. I'm just wondering, is there some way we could coexist to maybe erect some kind of caging around some of those trees? Because I know they gnaw them down and then, you know, top them and, you know, stuff all that in their dam there.
I think I'd recommend talking to a wildlife expert, somebody from the UW Extension, perhaps, about how to deal with beavers and other wildlife on your own land. I know that state wildlife areas, state natural areas are sometimes protected, and the beavers and the other wildlife have kind of the free reign there. So that's a good thing. On private land, I guess I don't know exactly what to advise you about protecting it from beavers, but I'd say call UW Extension.
Yeah, and the other place would be if you go online to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, I think they actually have information on that.
That's probably correct, yeah.
On that, because we've talked about that in the past on the show. So go to the Wisconsin DNR website, which is really a great website anyway.
Yeah.
And check in beaver and beaver damage.
Yeah.
And there's going to be something pop up.
Good point.
Thanks, Joe. Will in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Will.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say I'm a huge fan of this book. And I wanted to just say that I've had wonderful experiences at Devil's Lake with my family growing up. And I was just wondering if I could get a little bit of the history of that lake.
Yeah.
I know this, Will. he's my son. Devil's Lake, thanks, Will. Great question. Devil's Lake is a fascinating story. It's about an old river flowing through a gorge. And that gorge was plugged up at both ends by the glacier. Came down, and when glaciers move along, they pile up big, huge piles of gravel and sand and boulders called moraines, which I'm sure most listeners are familiar with that. And when the ice fades back, the moraine is left sitting there. Well, these two big moraines were placed at one at the north end of Devil's Lake and at the south end, kind of southeast, and blocked the gorge, and that lake filled up with water. It was a glacial lake that made by glacial meltwater, and it was once quite a bit deeper than it is now, but over time it stabilized at a depth of about 40 feet.
So there you have it. Well, thank you for calling. Jack in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Jack.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My mom and I were out hiking at Mirror Lake earlier in the fall, and I feel like that place is pretty cool. I mean, yes, Devil's Lake is awesome, and so are many of the other lakes around South Central Wisconsin, but part of what I like about that is just the way it's so long, and I would say free-flowing, I guess it kind of is, and just sort of the hills surrounding it. And so my question for you, guest, is how did Mirror Lake come to be, and I guess how did the process of Mirror Lake's warming stand out with that of other lakes in Wisconsin?
Good question. That lake is another case of a quick carving of a canyon with the Wisconsin Dells. I mean, that was another. All the water from Glacial Lake Wisconsin didn't just flow through the Wisconsin Dells. A lot of it flowed around, and some of it went through what's now Dell Creek. That's the creek that flows mm-hmm. into and out of Mirror Lake, and so there mm-hmm. again, you have a deep, relatively deep canyon for Wisconsin with mm-hmm. high walls on either side of it, and a beautiful little place.
And when the glacier melted?
When the glacier melted back, that carving hit, that little canyon had been carved deep enough so that it retained all that water. And the stream still flows in and out of it. But
yeah. Okay, Jack, thank you so much for calling. And Mike in Greenfield, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I've always wondered why the ancient sturgeon exist only in Lake Winnebago and the lakes surrounding Lake Winnebago, other than a few places in Russia, from what I understand. Do you have any answers as why that area has a population of fish that are fairly ancient?
Honestly, I don't really know the history of the sturgeon, although I think that they were in Lake Michigan, too.
Yeah.
I think, and they may have, let's see. Lake Michigan is connected. They were really good at working their way upstreams to do their spawning, and that may be how they got into Lake Winnebago, because the Fox River flows out of Winnebago and ultimately into Green Bay. So I believe that's probably where they came from.
I would say as well that there are sturgeon found in other areas. I know in the Bayfield area, for example, there are, I'm sure that sturgeon exists on some of the lakes there.
I believe that's right, yeah.
Black Lake, there are a number of lakes in that area where there are, Barker Lake, I know there were sturgeon in Barker Lake, which is not far from the city of Hayward. It's maybe 20 miles from Hayward or 25 miles from Hayward. So they do exist, but not to the extent that they exist in the Lake Winnebago chain. And Lake Winnebago, because of some great cooperation between the Department of Natural Resources and people who fish and so forth.
And the Menominee.
The Menominee Tribe. So there was a great combination of groups working together to keep that population thriving in Lake Winnebago. Mm-hmm. Lake Winnebago is set up, I think, really well for sturgeon population, but in terms of its food and so forth, it's a shallow water. Mm-hmm. What does it get? More than
21 feet deep.
Yeah, I think it's the deepest part it gets. Yeah. So I think the cooperation among groups has really kept the sturgeon population strong in Lake Winnebago.
Good point, yes.
Yeah.
In the Fox River,
Wolf River, yeah.
Where the Menominee depended on it for their survival.
You know, Marinette County in northeastern Wisconsin, it's home to many waterfalls, which I've enjoyed, and with my daughter Emily, we've enjoyed visiting. And Marinette County, has the nickname of the waterfall capital of Wisconsin. Why does that county have so many waterfalls?
Well, there again, the story is about the bedrock, and kind of a complicated story about how the ledges that over which the water flows were formed, but it's layering excuse me, it's layering of bedrock, and then the layers become exposed, and the edges of the harder rock make places where the water flows over and can't erode it very quickly, so it just makes this nice waterfall. And so there are just a few places in the state where you have these hard ledges of hard, really hard rock, and they don't wear away very fast. So the rivers flow down across those and toward the lake, and the rivers flow across. They flow perpendicular to these ledges of rock in Marinette County, making it a great place for waterfalls.
And I like the guide portion that you have in there too, telling people how to go and how to get there and what to do once you're there. What's your favorite? As probably you had at Patterson.
Oh, the waterfalls?
Yeah,
my favorite waterfalls. Well, it's a tough question to answer. I like them all, but the ones that are kind of the most surprising to me were the ones on the Montreal River, flowing away from the Hurley area and into the lake, into Lake Superior. There's a Superior Falls, there's Saxon Falls, there's, what's the other one? Sorry, Potato. Well, the Potato River is a different, but that area also has some really beautiful waterfalls. And then in Marinette County, I have to say, there's the 18-foot falls is one of my favorites. There's a 12 and a 8, and there's an 18-foot. So that's the name of it. So lots of great waterfalls.
Well, and Patterson State Park.
Patterson's the biggest.
Yeah, and Patterson State Park is... Yeah. He offers a really nice...
Big Manitou Falls. Biggest one in the state. Yeah,
yeah, that's a beautiful fall.
And very close by Lake Amnicon Falls State Park. Beautiful little park. You should go there with your daughter if you have.
Yeah, yes. We've been there. It's beautiful. Well, again, if you have a question, join in. 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Linda... I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this, but Linda in Milwaukee couldn't stay with us. She called, but couldn't stay with us. She wonders about the story of Nugget Lake in Pierce County.
Oh, that's a great story. It's an old meteor strike.
Oh.
It's a meteor struck, huge meteor struck 470 million years ago, I think it was, and made this big crater about 4 miles across. And since then, it's been filled in by glaciers and by farmers and people developing the land. There's still evidence of a big meteor strike there. There's a central kind of high point that you get, you know, like in meteors typically. And then around the edges are these areas where the meteor struck and just blasted the layers of bedrock and knocked them sideways and all cattywampus. And that's Nugget Creek. Flows. I'm not sure if Nugget Lake is dammed, if it's an artificial lake, but at any rate, Nugget Lake is right there near the edge of that meteor crater where the rock is all just jumbled, and it's a beautiful little park, Nugget Creek County Park, I think it's called.
That is, you wouldn't want to have been too close to that area when the meteor came in that big.
Yeah, it pulverized everything for miles and miles around.
Oh, thanks, Linda, for that question. Appreciate it. Let's see. We had Aaron wondering about the Fox River. We've talked about that from the Fox Cities to Green Bay before the locks were put in. I think you answered that. But let's talk about Green Bay and maybe Door County a bit. Of course, Lake Michigan, borders our state's famous Door County Peninsula. Mm-hmm. What's the story of Green Bay's formation?
Green Bay lies in a lowland that was, the bedrock there was shale, which is very much more easily eroded than the dolomite bedrock that forms the peninsula and the backbone of the peninsula, the Niagara Escarpment, that white, beautiful white rock that you see in the cliffs of Peninsula State Park and so on. And that's much tougher, harder rock to erode than the lowland next to it, which is Green Bay, but also Lake Winnebago and all the way down to Horicon Marsh, big, long lowland of different bedrock that's easier to erode. So the glaciers and all the other erosive forces just eroded that lowland out over time. And that's where Green Bay comes from. It's a lowland next to a high, rugged highland. And then the lake Michigan story is a little bit separate, but
What is the Lake Michigan story?
Oh, that's, well, it's a big, long, it's a huge glacial lake that was carved out by the glaciers. In over 2.5 million years, there were probably 15 or more glaciers that came down. We know the most about the last one or two of them, but they gradually just carved out the basins of all the Great Lakes. And Lake Michigan's got a great story. I could go on for quite a while about it. It's really quite interesting what lies under the surface there.
And that's, of course, you talk about in the book.
Yep.
And Superior as well. Aren't we lucky? Here we've got to be bordered by Lake Superior and Lake Michigan.
Yep.
And then down the western side of the state.
The St. Croix and the Mississippi.
The St. Croix and the Mississippi, and kind of running crosswise north and south across through the middle of the state, or through part of the state, the Wisconsin River.
Yeah, the Wisconsin River. And that's another fascinating story. It's really two different rivers.
Yeah, it's the upper and lower, right?
Yeah, it's two different rivers that got joined together eventually after the glacier came.
So the glacier joined them.
That's another complicated story. You should have Eric Carson, the National Natural Wisconsin...
Naturalist?
No, the Geology and Natural History Survey scientist, Eric Carson, has determined with his team that the lower Wisconsin once flowed east. And talking about surprises, that's one of the great ones. And it flowed down from the north and then across, cut where St. Lyalusing Park is now, and started flowing east. Well, it's a very long story, but it eventually got turned around by the glacier and by the way the waters eroded other channels and so on.
I've done the Grabar bicycle ride along the Wisconsin River, starting up in the north and all the way down to where it empties out in the state. And it's a fascinating, and it was called Wisconsin's certainly most working river.
Yeah, I think it's still is, isn't it? Yeah.
With the dams.
Mm-hmm.
That were built. If you had to choose a favorite waterway in the state, what would you choose?
Another tough question. I love them all. But I think, my home stomping grounds, the Lake Superior shore. Lake Superior is probably my favorite. I just love the lake and love to get up there whenever I can. So that would be, but it would be followed closely by a number of others.
So. Well, I tell you what, and you do a nice job on Lake Superior, and virtually all of the waters that you talk about in your book. It makes for fascinating read, Scott, and I want to thank you so much. And it was Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
That's correct.
Is the publisher. So, and I think if you go to a bookstore, you're going to find not only that one, but your State Parks book is still popular and out there.
Yep, all the bookstores that I know of in town have those books available.
Yeah. Scott, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's really a pleasure for me, too. Thanks.
Scott Spoolman, his book is titled Wisconsin Waters, and the subtitle, The Ancient History of Lakes, Rivers, and Waterfalls. Take a look at these. There's also a lot of good photography, some of it taken by Gail, his wife, as they traveled the state and did some of the research right on the ground, visiting lots of those places that he writes about in his book, Wisconsin Waters. Take a look. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to switch gears a little bit with you. We're going to talk about the American buffalo. Used to be a great population of buffalo in our country that went down to almost nothing and now has come back. And we're going to learn about some efforts now with our tribes across the nation to reestablish bison or buffalo on those reservations. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.